Okay, let's open that chapter together. Chapter 27 of the book of Acts. So it's an exciting day. This morning we were about treasure, and this evening we're on shipwreck. I mean, so we're going to look at this chapter that really Luke, I think, helps us feel like we're in the boat with Paul and his companions as they make their way towards Rome and as they are involved in this shipwreck. It's a clear, real eyewitness account of the voyage. So Luke, we have that first person plural, don't we? We, throughout this passage. Luke's there, and he helps us to feel like we're there as well, with details of places and people and plans and winds and desperate attempts to save the boat and its cargo. In fact, I was reading just this week that this is the most detailed account of the workings of an ancient ship that we have in sort of classical literature. This is, for historic value in that sense as well. So any sailors amongst us, I don't know if we have any sailors amongst us, or watching on perhaps, enjoy all the details of the ship and the voyage. Well, if you've ever been in a boat on a rough sea, you'll feel sympathy tonight for these people in our chapter. 276 of them. I mean, it's obviously a pretty big boat, that second boat that they get on, to have that many people on it. I can still vividly recall a journey from Rosslare to Fishguard on the Irish Sea on a really rough night. It was the most horrible experiences of my life. I mean, the boat was rolling everywhere. And the thing is, you can't get off, can you? You're there. You're stuck. There's nothing you can do. It's not like a fairground ride where you can sort of get off after 3 minutes. You're in it, aren't you? Well, that was about 5 hours, I think, from Rosslare to Fishguard. Well, there in this one lasts 2 weeks, isn't it? They're in the midst of this storm for about 2 weeks. Let me just remind you why Paul's in this boat. He's on his way to Rome. We've seen, haven't we? He's been arrested in Jerusalem. He's been taken to, he's been brought before the Sanhedrin. He's been on trial before Felix. He's been on trial before King Agrippa. He's been held in Caesarea down there on the coast for about 2 years. And knowing that he's not going to get a fair trial from the Jews, he's not going to get a fair trial in Jerusalem. He does the only thing really he can do. He appeals to Caesar. And so now, in this chapter, this journey to Rome begins. And we've seen, haven't we, there's a definite plan behind all of this. Not Paul's plan, God's plan. So you remember back in chapter 23 and verse 11, Paul has been given this word from the Lord. Chapter 23, verse 11. Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you've testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. The Lord makes it clear. He wants Paul to go to Rome, the center of the world at that time. And this is his way of getting him there as a prisoner, getting him into the heart of the Roman Empire, into the heart of the Roman Caesar's household, as we discover in Philippians, don't we? And in a sense, it's a glorious way in which the Lord does this, because don't forget, we've seen, haven't we, that there's the Jews are desperate to kill Paul. I mean, some of them have taken a vow, haven't they, that they're not going to eat or drink until they've killed him. So where better, really, for Paul to stay for 2 years than in the governor's quarters in Caesarea, surrounded by Roman soldiers? And then how better to get him, how much safer to get him to Rome than with an armed guard, basically? I mean, these soldiers think they're stopping Paul escaping, but I think the Lord's got them there to keep Paul safe on his journey. Well, these events then that seem uncertain, don't they, and unpredictable from a human point of view, they're absolutely in the hand of the Lord. And we can take courage from that again tonight, that we haven't been told exactly, like Paul has, where we're going to go. But we know the Lord knows where we're going to go. All the journeys of our lives, all the details of our lives, they're all known to the Lord, and we can trust him in them and leave them with him. He doesn't make any mistakes, and there's nothing unsure or uncertain with our God. So Paul then has been in Caesarea for about 2 years now, And now comes the departure for Rome. And this chapter then gives us this account of the voyage and the shipwreck. Let me just, I was going to show you before I did the reading and I forgot to do that. So here on the board is a map. Look, so sometimes it's helpful, isn't it, to see the journey. They start off from Caesarea. They're going to go up to Sidon. They then sail under Cyprus. We call it under, but that's what they meant by under. They go to Myra and then Nindus and then to Crete. This is where Fair Havens, where we'll see Paul says, we're not sure we should go any further. They want to get up to Phoenix and shelter there. But they start off and then it all goes. I mean, this is a wiggly line. I'm not sure we know exactly where they went for that period of time. But they end up then in Malta, and that's where they're going to be this evening. So we're not dealing with fantasy stories, are we? This isn't Never Never Land. This is real place. And real people. I would leave that up there, but that's too much of a risk that you spend the rest of the evening looking at the map behind me. So we won't do that. So what's the purpose of this chapter? Well, though it's fascinating, it's not given to us, is it, to instruct us, you know, handy tips for what you might do if you end up in a storm on the sea, you know, what to do with the anchors and so on. That's not the purpose of this chapter for us. So what are we to take from this chapter? Well, I want to look at it in this way. And if you've got a sheet, you'll see what we want to do tonight. Luke begins the chapter by giving us the name of this centurion. He's quite a fascinating chap, actually, really. Julius, there in verse 1, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. And this man features quite a lot in this chapter, doesn't he? And as we go through the chapter, it's clear that he's impacted by Paul. He's impacted by Paul's witness and testimony and life and the way that he speaks. He comes across a pretty reasonable, fair man, and he treats his prisoners well. There's no indication that he becomes a Christian that we know of, although it might quite likely that by the end of the voyage, I mean, not many people spent a lot of time with the Apostle Paul without being seriously affected, and many came to faith in Christ, didn't they? But tonight I want to think about, what did this man see then as he was there, as he watched Paul, as he took Paul on this journey? What did he see? What that must have struck him as he did so? And I want us then to see, well, these are things that people around us should be able to see in us, and in us together as a church, and in us individually. If people, we spend time with people at work or neighbours or whatever it should be, they should see something different about us. They shouldn't see what it means to be a Christian, what's involved in being a Christian. So let's just consider from this account what this man saw as this journey progressed. Well, the first thing he saw was Christian friendship and fellowship, true Christian friendship and fellowship, verses 2 and 3. So the voyage begins, presumably from Caesarea, and going with Paul, under no obligation to do so, is Luke, we've already said, the author of this book. That's why it goes all the way through this chapter. So he goes, and another person, verse 2, tells us that Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us as well. He's been one of Paul's traveling companions. We've come across him at various points through Acts. And I think that must have made an impression on this man. That two free men would go on this journey with Paul, clearly to keep him company and to support him. So Aristarchus has already experienced what a journey with the Apostle Paul could be like. He was actually one of the men that the crowd in Ephesus, you remember that story where there's a riot in Ephesus because people are not buying the idols anymore, and they don't get hold of Paul, but they drag some other people, and Aristarchus, the Macedonian, is one of those people. So he knows what it's like to go on a journey with Paul and be alongside Paul. He knows that, you know, it can be pretty hairy, and all sorts of things can happen. You never know quite what's going to happen next. But here he is still on this journey with the Apostle Paul. And it was a serious thing to be associated with a prisoner. You didn't do that lightly in the first century. So there's these two men, and that must have struck, you know, here he is, here's Paul coming on board, and here's two other men. I imagine they must have had to pay their way, mustn't they? I mean, you don't just get a free trip on a boat. And then they go up the coast a bit, don't they? They go up, you remember what I showed you on the map, they go up, verse 3, they go up to Sidon. And then we're told, Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Now, we've not been told in Acts that Paul ever went to there before. We don't know all of Paul's movements. We're not told everything in Acts, quite clearly, as we'll see in a moment. But clearly by friends, we mean believers, don't we? We mean fellow Christians. Paul has believing brothers and sisters in Christ in Sidon. Whether they've met him before, whether he's met them in other places, they're there. And he's given permission by the centurion, by Julius. I imagine probably a soldier goes with him, but he's allowed to go and spend time with these people, and they give him care. They receive him, and they give him care. That means they take him into his house, and they look after him, and they're pleased to see him, and they're pleased to have him, and they show him love and Christian fellowship and friendship. Now, again, I don't imagine all the prisoners go, oh, do you mind if we go off and see all that? I don't imagine anyone else did that, but Paul does that. I'm sure that the centurion would have noted that. He saw true Christian friendship and companionship and love. And that's one of the joys of being a Christian, isn't it? Of the Christian life, that we have friends and brothers and sisters in Christ all around the world. And there's love and there's real friendship and there's real fellowship that transcends all other barriers. And we must make sure that's true of us here, mustn't we? That when people come, when visitors come, when people come on holiday, that we were friendly to them and we show them love and care and perhaps invite them round for lunch and take care of their needs if they have any. I've said the centurion was bound to note that, but the New Testament makes clear, doesn't it? That's part of our testimony, isn't it? That Jesus said, John 13:35, by this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have a love for one another. That should mark us out. People around us should see that. They should be struck by that. That they know something of us here in the people in the village and around, and people that you know that you come here, and they should be struck. And they, wow, those Christians, they care for each other, don't they? If they're in need, well, there's people going around, there's people bringing meals and whatever it might be. They care for one another. That should be part of our testimony. That should strike people about us. People should see that, shouldn't they? Okay, that's the first thing. He saw true Christian fellowship. Second thing, he saw Christian common sense. Some Christians do actually have common sense. It is They sail from Sidon. We saw that, didn't we? They sail round Cyprus to Myra. We're told that, and they board in another ship. So they're on a little smaller ship to start with. Probably one of the ships that just go round the coast a bit. And then they get on this ship from Alexandria, sailing to Italy. It's a grain ship. We know that grain came up from Alexandria, from Africa, and there was a very clear known route that went up then to Italy. And they sailed to Crete with some difficulty, and the harbour, we're told, at this place called Fair Havens. And then the ship's helmsman and the owner want to go on, and it's about another 40 miles, apparently, round the coast to a better harbour, a place that they think is safer, a place called Phoenix. And Paul has something to say, doesn't he? Look at verse 10. Verse 9, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives." Now, so Paul's got something. Now, don't forget, Paul's he's an experienced seafarer. He sailed on the Mediterranean, we know from Acts, at least 11 times. Actually, 2 Corinthians, which was written before the events of this chapter, 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25, sends about Paul's already experienced 3 shipwrecks. We're not told about them in Acts, but he speaks about them. He was shipwrecked 3 times. That's before the events of this chapter. You didn't get on a ship with Paul without being a bit afraid, did you? He spent a day and a night in the deep, he says in that chapter as well, doesn't he? So he's clearly aware of the dangers of the sea. But he's an experienced voyager. He's done a lot of sailing. So this isn't just some sort of nervous landlubber who doesn't like the look of the sea that day. He's the fast that's spoken of in verse 9 would have been the Day of Atonement. That was, according to records, was early October in that year. So sailing, well, you were reluctant in the first century to sail from October through to about February, March. That was not much sailing went on during that time. So they're on the edge of it. And considering the dangers then, Paul advises them not to travel, but to stay where they are. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Don't you find that? So Paul, his trust in God doesn't make him reckless. He doesn't just say, well, God's sovereign. God said, I'm going to get to Rome. You just do what you like. It doesn't matter. You know, we just go whatever you like. No, he's thinking about it. There's some common sense. He's going, I'm not really sure that we should be sailing now. This is a dangerous time. I think we should stay here. And so the centurion sees that, doesn't he? He sees that, this Christian, he's not just a fatalistic, blind faith. It involves trust in God, but that doesn't shed us of our responsibility to use common sense. I think that's important, isn't it? We should be the same. We believe that all things work together for good. We believe that God is sovereign, and he has a plan for our lives. And we believe, as we'll sing at the end, not a single shaft can hit till the God of love sees fit. We believe that, don't we? But that doesn't make us sort of fatalistic. We don't go, well, you know, I'm just going to, you know, never mind about whatever, any dangers, COVID, whatever it might be. Oh, you know, God's going to, we use common sense. We're wise. We're sensible. Whether it's driving the car or making plans, we should, and people around us should see that. We're not just sort of fatalistic. You know, there are religions, aren't they? Well, you know, whatever will be, you know, but we're not like that. We're wise, we're thoughtful, we're careful. And people should say, oh, they speak wisely, those Christians. They've got some common sense. They think we're fools for believing the gospel, but they should see, even though I think that of them, yeah, they're not stupid. They're wise. So this man saw Christian fellowship, and he saw Christian common sense, and he saw Christian courage as well, didn't he? Verses 13 through to 26, a big section. So centurion, rather than listening to Paul's advice, listens to the advice of the helmsman and the owner. We don't blame him for that, do we? But he decides that they should try and sail on to Phoenix. And to start with, we're told the wind seems favourable, and okay, here we go, let's go for it. And out they go. And yet before long, we're told, aren't we, that this wind comes, tempestuous headwind called Euroclydon, a northeaster. And suddenly they're in the midst of a great storm. And it's clear early on, isn't it, that it's a bad storm. So what do? They pull the skiff aboard the boat. That's a little boat that goes along on a rope behind, you know, that to get you to shore when they pull it up on board. They've got to get that on board because they're going to lose that. And then they further strengthen the hull by passing cables under the boat and tying them up together, trying to get the boat a bit tighter because the boat's being bashed about. And then they lower the mainsail, we're told, and they allow the ship to be driven. So it's such a wind. You don't put a sail up when there's a wind like that. You'll all get blown apart, and the whole thing will come down. So the sail comes down. Well, we're just going to let the boat go. The following day, look at verse 18, they jettison, they lighten the ship, so they get rid of some of the cargo overboard. So your Amazon boxes, they're all chucked over the edge. And the next day, they throw overboard, verse 19, that the ship's tackle, some of the equipment on the ship. I mean, you don't do that lightly, do you? You've got to be in a pretty desperate state to do that. It's got to be a pretty serious storm. The boat's got to be going up and down and up and down, and you're wondering whether the next wave's going to tip it over. So you go, well, let's get rid of this. We don't need this at the moment. Let's chuck that over and lighten the ship, bring it up out of the water a bit further. And then verse 20, the storm goes on for many days. They don't see the sun or the stars to help them. Where are we? Well, you know, they can't get out the phone and work it out. There's no Google Maps. There's you look at the stars or the sun, but they don't know where they are. And it's at that point then that Paul's courage, you see, they've given up all hope of survival, it says, doesn't it, in verse 20. It's at that point that Paul's courage is seen. And it's a courage that came from trust in God. That's often when a person's real character is seen, isn't it? Or when your faith is really displayed or not displayed, when the storm comes. You know, it's all right when the weather's fair and everything's, you know, the sea's calm, as it were, the sea of life is calm. But it's when the storm comes, isn't it? Oh, do you really trust God? Are you really, is your confidence really in him? And here's Paul in the storm. All hope's gone, but it's real faith and courage. So God gives him a promise, doesn't he? An angel of the Lord comes who tells him, he doesn't need to be afraid. Though the ship's going to be lost, he and those on the ship are going to be saved. He says, verse 24, you must be brought to Caesar. So this angel has appeared to him. It seems from that verse, doesn't it, that Paul has been praying for everybody on board. What does it say, verse 24? Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all who sail with you. So I take from that, Paul's been praying, hasn't he? He's been praying, Lord, have mercy on these people. Lord, keep these people. May they not be lost in the sea. A reminder of the power of prayer. And as Paul addresses these people, he tells them, be of good courage. And now you imagine the centurion watching that. He sees this man of courage. Here's a man who's got faith in his God. And he's able to speak. He's not in panic. He's not in despair. He's showing Christian courage. You can imagine the impact that would have had. And as I say, it's in the trials of life, isn't it, that how much we really trust God is seen. And Paul had an angel. You go, well, yeah, that's all right. If I had an angel come and tell me, it'd be all right. But we've got this book, haven't we? It's God's words and full of promises of God's help and his presence, and he'll never leave us or forsake us, and he's working all things together for good. Isn't that good enough for us? We believe it's the Bible. Well, if we do, that will give us courage, won't it? So that we'll be able to stand out. People will go, wow, here they are. They're in a real storm. But there's a calmness there. That ought to strike people around us, shouldn't it? That we're all been in this storm of COVID for the last year and a half. I wonder if we stood out as Christians. If we've got confidence in God, we're not stupid. We're wise because we've seen. We use common sense, but we've got a confidence and a courage in our God. So that's what he sees. He sees Christian courage. He sees Christian devotion. I just want to focus in on verse 23. He says there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. That's how Paul views his life, how Paul conducted his life. He knew that he belonged to God. His life wasn't his own anymore. He's been redeemed. He's been purchased. And his life belongs to God. He's been brought by the blood of Christ. And he's now Christ. And as a consequence of that, he serves God. I belong to God and I serve God. And that, of course, we've just seen that, haven't we? Throughout Paul's life and throughout this Luke's account of his life, here's something none of us can deny, that here's a man who knows, I've been bought, I belong to God, and I'm serving God. You can't have any other explanation for Paul's life and the way that he lived other than that. And this man can see that. Why is Paul a prisoner? Why is he appealed to Caesar? Because of his faith. Because he belongs to God and serves God. Everyone, if we're Christians tonight, that's we can say that, can't we? That's true of us. We belong to God and we serve him. That should be seen. People around us should go, yeah, they're a bit nuts. I don't understand everything, but this is, I know this. They belong to God and they serve God. I might not agree with them, but I can see that in them. There's a reality in their lives. They're not playing at this. So we want people to understand, don't we, that we're not playing our Christianity. It's real. We belong to God and we serve him. I'm sure that centurion wasn't going, oh, I don't believe that about Paul. He knew that that was true of him. Or that might be clearly seen in us. What did they see? They saw Christian fellowship. He saw Christian common sense and Christian courage and real Christian devotion. And he saw Christian thankfulness as well. I think this is striking, isn't it? In the midst of the storm, the way in which Paul gives thanks. He's been in the midst of this storm for a long time, and then when it seems like the boat's going to be smashed up and their lives are in danger, yet even in the midst of that, as Paul eats, he gives thanks before the Lord. There it is in verse 34, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And when he said these things, he took bread and he gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he'd broken it, he began to eat. So not just the centurion, but they all saw this. Here's a man who believed his food came from God. And he says grace and he gives thanks to God in the presence of them all. It's not a sort of, did anyone notice I was praying? He's unashamed, isn't he? And he gives thanks. And the man must have seen that. He's a man. He's, well, here we are in the midst of a storm. We don't, you know, he's saying our lives are going to be all right, but we don't know. And all this is going on, and yet he's not. He's giving thanks. He's a thankful man. I mean, that ought to strike people about us. That ought to be seen in us, isn't it? That whatever's coming, we're people who are profoundly thankful. We're aware of all that God gives us. We're aware that our food comes from him. I think that was partly what impacted the Philippian jailer, wasn't it? When there was Paul and Silas in prison all back there. You remember that? And what are they doing at midnight? They're praising God. They're giving thanks to God. Humanly speaking, my wife and children wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for someone giving thanks for their food. Because my father-in-law, when he went to, he was in the RAF at Wattisham. And he arrived there and he sat down for his lunch at the table in the mess. It would have been very easy, wouldn't it, to just give thanks with your eyes open and just not get too anybody notice. It would be a bit embarrassing, but he didn't. He closed his eyes and bowed his head and gave thanks for his food. And a man that we referred to for many years as Uncle Bill, he was a member at Wattisham, saw him, went over to him and said, oh, are you a Christian? And, oh, you ought to come to our church, Wattisham. And so he went along to the church at Wattisham, and there was a lovely young lady called Daphne LeGrice. And so they met. And if he hadn't prayed and given thanks that night, well, that whole pew wouldn't be here this evening, which would be rather concerning for me. But who knows? We should be marked, shouldn't we? We shouldn't be ashamed. We give thanks to God. That's what that man saw. He saw Christian thankfulness. And then he saw Christian trust rewarded. They sensed that the land's near. You can just imagine this. This is a gripping scene, isn't it? The whole thing. In the middle of the night now. The soldiers get this sense, don't they? We're getting near to land. They can tell they're experienced men, perhaps just the way the waves are, whatever it might be. Put a rope down, 20 fathoms. Put a rope down a bit later, 15 fathoms. We're getting near to shore, but we can't see anything. So what do you do? Well, you chuck out some anchors and hope that they stop the boat. And they do, and they pray for light for day to come, it says. You can just picture it, can't you? You can just experience that. Oh, in the night, you don't know where you are, just hoping for dawn to come. Are you going to see anything? And then the light comes and they can see the coast of what turns out to be Malta, that little islands, and they see a beach they might better make it to, and so they have to cut the ropes of the anchor because it's all pulling, isn't it? And they put the sail up with the hope to just get blown into this bay. And yet, you know, we read what happens: the boat gets stuck in the sand or wherever it was, and the back of the boat's being broken up. And so the soldiers want to kill all the prisoners. You say, well, that's a bit mean, but if a prisoner got away, you know, the soldiers who were guarding them would be punished with the punishment that they were going to get. So better kill them than let them escape. But it says, isn't it, that the centurion wanting to save Paul, he's had an impression on him, hasn't he? He's not prepared to just let him die. He commands everyone to jump overboard, and those who can swim to swim, and those who can't to grab hold of something and make it to shore. And they all make it to shore. And what does he see? He sees Christian trust rewarded. Paul had trusted that those promises of God, and God's word had come true and been fulfilled. Yeah, here in that particular way, in a miraculous way. But faith rewarded, faith justified, if you like. And as we trust in God, and as we rest our lives on Him and His words, then people should see that, shouldn't they? That He is the God who's keeping us. He is the God who's watching over us. And ultimately, of course, that's going to be so on the judgment day, isn't it? When trust in God is finally vindicated. So, what did this centurion see? All these things: Christian fellowship, Christian common sense, Christian courage, Christian devotion, Christian thankfulness, Christian trust rewarded. And I'm saying tonight that that's what the people who look on our lives and are brought in God's providence to our lives should see in us individually, but also together as a people. And we need to pray that that might be so, for the glory of our God.